It's Monday, September 14th. Is life on the West Coast going up in smoke permanently? We start here. In a deadly trend, wildfires continue to ravage California and Oregon and Washington.
The trees were exploding like someone had put dynamite in them.
But what's causing them? From climate change to forest management, we'll break down the buzzwords with an actual scientist. After weeks of anger and years of distrust, two sheriff's deputies are gunned down in Los Angeles. Scenes continued to get ugly from there. We'll take you to the scene. And Joe Biden's doing better than Hillary Clinton was, except here.
What we've seen is a dramatic flip-flop in Latino voter support.
With 50 days to go, this is the number that has Democratic strategists worried. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Heading into this weekend, California's Fire Authority put out a list of the 20 biggest wildfires in state history. Five of them were from this year. And the situation on the West Coast actually got worse after that day.
Entire neighborhoods incinerated. Nearly 5 million acres have burned in California, Oregon, and Washington state.
The death toll has now risen into the dozens. Entire towns have been evacuated.
The trees were exploding like someone had put dynamite in them.
I was in flames, like engulfed in my car. I can't believe the tires didn't pop or something, you know?
And the question this morning is, why? Is this just a freak year? Before you answer, consider this. I said five this year. Well, out of those 20 wildfires on the California list, 18 of them have happened in the last 20 years. So if this is the new normal, what do we do about it? Let's start the morning with an expert. Brian Harvey is with the School of Environmental and Forest Sciences at the University of Washington in the Pacific Northwest. He studies fire ecology. I mean, Professor Harvey, what is happening on the West Coast right now? What's sticking out to you about this fire season?
Really, what's going on here is we're starting to see unfold the effects of a warming climate on the fire challenges throughout the Western United States and also elsewhere in the world in recent years. California has broken fire records in the last 3 years.
More than 3.3 million acres, roughly the size of Connecticut, have been scorched this year alone. 27 times the amount burned at this time last year.
And in fact, that's just about what a lot of the fire and climate simulation models have been telling us is likely to occur as the climate continues to warm.
Governor Jay Inslee says the devastating fires that have burned thousands of acres throughout the state are a direct result of climate change.
They're climate fires because that's what creates the conditions that makes them so explosive.
Well, and what's so disturbing here is, you know, we're used to California blazes. We're not used to this many, and we're certainly not used to such big ones in the very green Pacific Northwest. We've had people say that climate change is clearly the instigator of all this. We've also had people say, hey, don't forget land management, forest management. How responsible are those each for what we're seeing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And in fact, the answer is both.
The debate is over around climate change. Just come to the state of California.
Climate change is making the fire challenges harder to contain across fire-prone regions in the U.S.
A record-breaking day here in Woodland Hills. The temperature reaching a scorching 121 degrees this afternoon.
That's warming temperatures dry things out. They make anything more burnable.
There's so many dead trees in the area, drought conditions, hot weather. It's a very intense high-temperature fire.
And climate and fire models for the last few decades have been predicting the kinds of increases in fire activity that we've been seeing. And if the climate continues to warm, we should expect to see more of this.
But you know, it is about forest management. Please remember the words, very simple. Forest management, please remember.
So now when it comes to fuels and forest management, that answer really varies across different kinds of forests. So over much of the western U.S., in forests historically characterized by frequent fire.
This is a new school approach to an old school job. Loggers leave the biggest trees standing, but clear out the overgrown forest underneath.
And someday, no doubt, a fire will come through here. And I know for a fact it'll probably stop because of the work we've done.
So as you move up into the northwest here in northwest Oregon and Washington, on the east side of the Cascades, we've got forests that are much more typical of what people probably think of when they hear the term fire-prone forests. But fire has been missing from many of those landscapes for the last 100 years or so when we've been relatively effective at suppressing fires. And that's led to build up of fuel as these forests grew without the frequent fires that they historically experienced.
Great progress has been made in developing organization of crews for faster production of fire line and for other special tasks.
However, if we come back to some of these more coastal areas, like the lush green forests on the coastal parts of Washington on the west part of the state here, when the conditions are right, these forests will burn. And so suppressing wildfires as soon as an ignition is detected actually makes a lot more sense on the wet and west side of the Cascades.
Oh, so you could make a case that you actually would want to see burning as far as fuel removal in some of these more fire-prone areas. But then that raises the question of, you know, do people still live in these places? How expansive is the burning? But you just know that, like, these places are going to light up very often going forward. The wetter spots, like, when they burn huge. So you quickly put out those fires, but then you just got to hope that, I guess, climate change doesn't just permanently make them into big fuel-filled tinderboxes.
And so one way to think about this is that as the climate warms, the potential for fires on the west side of the Cascades is expected to increase. So the other ingredients have always been there.
The Cascade snowpacks have gotten smaller. Our forests have gotten drier. Our ocean has gotten warmer and more acidic.
Fuels have always been there. There have been ignitions on the landscape. But really what's happening is, as the climate warms, it's increasing the window of time when those key ingredients for fire are going to coincide. Two of my colleagues, Dan Donato and Crystal Raymond, said earlier this week, climate change is loading the dice for fires, and essentially it's taking one of those ingredients that's needed for fire, that being the warm, dry conditions, and essentially increasing that ingredient and increasing the probability or the potential for fire to occur over a longer period of time.
Yeah, these issues all kind of coming together in an argument that can sometimes feel very theoretical. Not theoretical to the families of more than 25 people who have died, thousands of people displaced right now on the West Coast. Brian Harvey from the University of Washington. Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The last time we talked about the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department was a couple weeks ago, when they were under fire for the killing of a man they had stopped for a bicycle violation.
Family members gathered at the scene, identifying the victim as 29-year-old Dijon Kizzy. Witnesses told them he was shot numerous times.
He didn't deserve to be shot no 20 times. And they said his hands was up. That didn't make no sense.
There was outrage, but then this weekend, as two other deputies sat in their squad car, someone went up and fired gunshots at them. ABC's Zareen Shaw is in Los Angeles outside the sheriff's department this morning. Zareen, I mean, what happened there?
Yeah, Brad, they were sitting very close to the sheriff's station right here in Compton, sitting in their vehicle when a suspect walked up dressed in black.
He acted as if he was going to walk past the car, and then he made a left turn directly toward the car, raised a pistol,
held out his arm with a gun, shot them multiple times, and then just ran off.
Next thing you see, the passenger door flings open and the deputy emerges and stumbles. Two LA County Sheriff's deputies shot in the head.
Now, they were in a really well-lit area. It was around 7 o'clock on Saturday. They were okay enough, alert enough, to radio in for their own help. A deputy rushed them to the ICU where they were in critical condition. They went through surgery, and now they're in critical but stable condition.
The two deputies were doing their job, minding their own business, and watching out for the safety of the people on the train, and seeing somebody just walk up and just start shooting on them. It pisses me off. It dismays me at the same time, and there's no pretty way to say it.
Brad, these shootings are always heartbreaking, but one thing that makes this one just especially just gut-wrenching is these deputies were just sworn in 14 months ago. One of them is a 31-year-old mother of a 6-year-old. The other one is a 24-year-old man.
Well, and so for all the protests, it's still unclear what exactly motivated this shooting, but I have to imagine, Zareen, that this is coloring how people see these protests and this tension between, you know, law enforcement and citizens.
Yeah, right. Tensions were already high between so many people in this city and law enforcement.
Meanwhile, reaction to the shooting is unfolding. A small group of demonstrators gathered outside the hospital where those two deputies are being treated.
Over the weekend, after the deputies were taken to the hospital, there was a small group of protesters waiting outside,
blocking the emergency entrance and exit to the hospital. A witness says some of the demonstrators even tried to get inside the building.
Just completely bizarre. We've never seen anything like this. They were growing incredibly tense with the deputies who were out there, saying things like they hoped that they would die.
Shortly after that recording of the protest, a radio reporter was tackled to the ground by deputies outside of the hospital.
It just shows this growing anti-law enforcement sentiment that we've been seeing here for the last several months.
And this is today about law and order, when you see a scene like happened just last night.
So, Brad, all this just set the stage for President Trump to weigh in on all of this, fanning the flames.
Shot at stone-cold, short range, right through a window.
Retweeting the video of the suspect shooting the deputies and writing, "Animals that must be hit hard." And then in another tweet said, "If they die," referring to the sheriff deputies, "fast trial death penalty for the killer, only way to stop this." So, Brad, authorities still haven't given any real description of who this person is. They are still trying to track him down, but they have offered up a $100,000 reward for any information leading to his arrest.
And you mentioned the language from President Trump about this case. He also talked about that case in Oregon where you had a suspect who allegedly shot a right-wing demonstrator in Portland. Police caught up with the suspect, shot him dead. President Trump has now said, quote, "That's the way it has to be. There has to be retribution," end quote. Zareen Shah in Los Angeles. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, 4 years after calling Mexicans rapists, Donald Trump is doing better with Latino voters than ever in one of his most crucial states. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
As of this morning, we are exactly 50 days out from November 3rd. 50 days. If you go to the 538 election forecast right now, former Vice President Joe Biden now has a 3 out of 4 shot at winning. A favorite, but not a prohibitive favorite. 4-1 underdogs win all the time. This weekend, though, there was more bad news for President Trump.
A report released by Politico claiming staff within the administration openly pushed for CDC reporting to better align with President Trump's optimistic claims.
A new ABC News Ipsos poll shows deep skepticism over the president's handling handling of COVID-19. In fact, nearly a third of Republicans say he did not respond quickly enough to the realities of this pandemic. Republicans usually do well on questions about the military, right? Well, in this poll, nearly two out of three Americans said Joe Biden has more respect for military members. But if you dig into the data here, there are some big concerns for the Biden campaign. Let's go back to the 538 forecast real quick. They highlight states that could probably be the tipping point for the whole thing. Florida is one of those states. Trump needs it. If Biden wins it, he's probably going to win the presidency. Compared to Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden is doing better in almost every Florida demographic, except one. Let's go to ABC's campaign journalist Armando Garcia. Armando, what are you seeing in the polls here?
Brad, what we've seen is a dramatic flip-flop in Latino voter support, where back in July, a Quinnipiac poll had Biden with a 17-point lead over the president among this demographic in Florida. But last week, an NBC Marist poll showed Biden trailing the president 46-50%. Now, when you look at 2016, Clinton bested Trump among Latinos in Florida 62-35%. This is a major cause for concern among some Latino advocates. Why? Because in less than 2 weeks, eligible voters will be receiving their mail-in ballots in Florida, and they say that the time to court these voters is now or never.
Hispanics like tough people. They like people that are going to produce jobs. They like, and by the way, the Hispanics understand the border better than anybody else.
Wait, so, I mean, not to be naive, Armando, but how is that possible? Like, during the last campaign, Donald Trump called Mexicans rapists. Since then, after that, we saw chunks of actual border walls go up, right? We saw child separation policies in action. So why would the president be doing better with Latinos 4 years later?
Brad, it's tough to tell from where we are standing right now for a few different reasons. Number one, Latinos are historically underpolled and underreported in surveys of voting trends and even demographic estimates.
A typical 800-person national poll might interview around 100 Hispanic voters, for example. That's associated with a margin of error of plus or minus almost 10 points.
However, we know that there are about 3.1 million eligible Latino voters in Florida. That's a lot of people, especially in a state that is historically won by very thin margins. Clinton lost the state to Trump by a little over 1%, meaning that every single vote counts.
The Latino vote is essential in winning this election and making sure that Donald Trump is a one-term president.
I currently don't know like what his platform is going to be. Other than, you know, I'm better than Donald Trump.
Now, advocates I've spoken to say that this is a wake-up call for Democrats, that they haven't done enough outreach not only to get their messaging out, but to register new voters.
Some of the concerns about the Latino vote have been echoed by Bernie Sanders, and there's a front-page story in the Washington Post. The senator has identified several specific changes he'd like to see, saying Biden should talk more about health care and about his economic plans and should campaign more with figures popular among young liberals, such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
And we have to remember, Latinos are projected to be the largest group of non-white eligible voters in 2020, and they are not a monolith. They hail from dozens of countries, different backgrounds, political experiences that shape the way they look at candidates when they go to the polls.
A lot of like Hispanic people, you know, they see immigration as a problem. And they say like my parents or my grandparents came here legally. Why can't these people come here legally?
Los demócratas y Joe Biden son demasiado extremistas.
What we're also seeing is a battle of the airwaves in Florida where ads are targeting Biden, trying to paint him as a communist or as a socialist.
Socialismo, cortarle los fondos a la policía.
Which obviously strikes a nerve from people where socialism may equate with political strife. Venezuela, Cuba. Just to name a few.
Oh, so like if you're President Trump and you're saying, hey, this guy's a socialist, like that resonates in a way that it might not in another state.
Right. But in theory, it could actually go beyond that. A Republican strategist told me that when you have growing communities in states like California and Arizona, of Nicaraguans in particular, you know, someone from a country like Nicaragua, they may not be super trustful of the idea of big government. So Trump could really capitalize on that.
We implemented massive tax cuts, regulation cuts, and opportunity zones for Hispanic American families and small businesses, for African American families.
And when you look at spending, Trump has almost spent as much as Biden on Spanish language television. So some Democratic strategists I spoke to say the campaign is simply not spending enough to reach out to Spanish-speaking voters.
Este noviembre cuenta con Joe Biden.
The campaign has spent approximately $62.3 million on Spanish-language ads in Florida, with roughly $3.6 million of that going to Spanish-language
stations.
Well, okay, so then realistically then, what are you expecting to see in the next 50 days in like what could be, what always seems to be one of the most important and closest states?
Well, I'm watching for how they increase the amount of money that they're spending on Spanish-speaking ads, and also looking at how they micro-target populations within the Latino community. They recently came out with one such ad, with Puerto Rican rapper Bad Bunny singing over images of Trump tossing paper towels in the wake of Hurricane Maria. The song titled Pero Ya No, which translates to But Not Anymore, targets those Puerto Ricans who may have favored the president in 2016 that they can potentially win over this time around. I have a feeling we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the next few days.
And we've now learned that the billionaire Michael Bloomberg will actually be spending $100 million to help Biden win Florida alone. 50 days out. Armando Garcia tracking it all. Thanks so much, Armando.
Thank you, Brad.
And one last thing. There's a date circled on the tech world's calendar. That day is tomorrow.
So TikTok. TikTok is very successful. It does tremendous business in the United States. People are riveted by it.
Tomorrow is the deadline set by President Trump by which TikTok has to be sold to an American buyer before it gets blocked by the U.S. government.
Many friends, when they saw that announcement, they're calling. I think their kids love it. They don't, because they don't get to see their kids anymore. But they are. It's an amazing thing, whatever it may be. And
last night, the leading contender, Microsoft, announced it's not going to be them. Apparently, it's going to Oracle. But the lingering question is, does Oracle get the car that is TikTok, or does it also get the engine inside?
Let's talk numbers. How big are you?
How big am I? I hate talking about numbers. I have 29 million on TikTok.
See, the thing that makes TikTok special is not just the stuff that lets you make a music video. It's not just the viral dances. The real magic are the algorithms that seem to know what you'll want to watch before you even know you want to watch them. They're entire ecosystems for people who just want to watch horse trainers train horses. You into whale TikTok? You only know that because the algo served it up to you. And even if ByteDance, the Chinese company that owns it, sells TikTok, that doesn't mean they'll be allowed to sell those algorithms. The China Morning Post is reporting the government, which has new export powers, is forbidding it. Which leads to another question. Does the sale have to be done by tomorrow? Or is a vague announcement of a deal enough? In the immortal words of TikTokers, why don't you say so? A big day on the app today. Start here tomorrow. Thanks so much for the ratings and reviews last week. They do really help us get discovered by other algorithms, American algorithms. You know, do your duty. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.